morning, everyone, and welcome. It's our privilege today to continue our study of Christian evidences, and we'll get into that in just a minute. I want to let you know there are some outlines on the table that Marcia has set up here in the foyer. There's some outlines that cover what we've gone through up to this point. So that's basically the background and introductory material, and then the cosmological arguments that we looked at, concluding with those last week. So if you're interested in one of those, please feel free to pick it up. There's 20 or 21 of them back there, and we can make more if we need to, and we'll add to those as we go, and continue to make those available. Up until this point in the study, we have been focused on, at least in terms of the arguments for the existence of God, we've been focused on the cosmological argument, which is an argument, or a set of arguments, really, that deal with the issue of why there is something rather than nothing. The argument basically runs, and we looked at lots of details and sort of refined things, but it basically says, if there was ever at any time nothing, actually nothing, then there would always be nothing. And so that's a basic argument that just seeks to explain why, when we look out in the universe, there is something rather than nothing. Of course, to be able to look out at all entails there being something. But why is there something rather than nothing? And so that's where we started out. In this class, we want to move on from there in the sort of take the next step in a line of reasoning for establishing the existence of God. And that is to look at the what are called often teleological arguments or design arguments. So the issue now has changed a little bit. We know there's stuff, okay, that we know there has to have been a cause for the stuff, for the existence rather than non-existence of the universe. Okay, that's cosmological. But now that we have the stuff, we want to look at it and see what's there and see if there's any order or any arrangement or any design or any purpose or any goal that seems to be served by the stuff that exists. Okay? There is stuff, but what can we learn by a study of it? And those are the sorts of things that are entailed by the teleological line of reasoning. Teleological comes from a word that has to do with design or purpose or goal. Is there some goal that the physical universe seems to enable or seems to accomplish? Those are the sorts of questions we want to look at. If you remember back a couple of weeks, whenever we started the cosmological argument, we said that we should focus and spend some time focusing on and meditating on even what nothing would look like. What would nothing look like? We said, really, it's hard to even conceptualize what nothing looks like. The analog for that under the teleological line of reasoning, I think, is to think about and meditate on and focus on, at least for a few minutes of your life, of my life, what would randomness look like? What would a universe governed by absolute randomness, if there were no choices to bring out particular ends or goals that had ever been made in the universe in the past or in the present, if there was no design or effort for accomplishing particular goals ever exerted, what would that look like? What would randomness look like? What is randomness? What would a random universe appear to us as, if we could even look at it? Why is it the case that there seems to be more disorder than order? Or why does it seem to be the case, if you think about it, that you would expect there to be more disorder than order? More chaos, more randomness than order. What happens to things naturally if we leave them to themselves? If you set off an explosion at some location, and there's this sudden amount of energy that's released, what kinds of things does that random explosion tend to accomplish? And there are lots of other questions we could consider under this heading, but I want us to just begin by thinking briefly about what randomness, undirected random processes can accomplish. We'll come back to this more whenever we get into a study more of biological systems and so forth, but I just want to kind of introduce the idea now and have us thinking about it on some level. Other words for the idea of a random process would be a process that is undirected. It involves chance. There's no purpose that's been inserted from the outside. It's just letting things run as they would of their own accord. These are accidents. There is arbitrariness in random processes. They are erratic and variable and subject to the whims of happenstance. They're haphazard. They are aimless. And you could imagine several other words that might be attached to a random process. In statistics, you study random processes, and here are a couple of examples, and we'll think about these in some more detail later on. But just imagine flipping a coin. This is roughly a random process. As long as I throw it sufficiently high enough and put enough spin on it that I couldn't predict what the result will be. Okay? Now, I can say on the whole what the likeliness of a particular outcome may be. Okay, but I can't predict in a particular instance what will happen, what will result if I flip a coin, let it land on the floor, and then record the side of it that's facing upward, say. Okay, so flipping a coin we think of as a random process. Same with rolling, say, a six-sided die. If we roll a die, in a way that's robust, right? You genuinely shake it, you genuinely throw it up in the air, and then record the top number. Okay, that's a random process. Now again, there are particular likelihoods that a given outcome will occur, okay, and we can say what those will be on the whole, but in any particular example, we cannot say what will occur. Okay, it's called a random process for that reason. Some of you are familiar with Plinko, which is another process that's thought of to be random. Plinko, I know this was done on The Price is Right and maybe in other places, but it's a popular experiment where an object is dropped into the top of an array of pegs, a board with an array of pegs on it, and then the object bounces either left or right at each peg and traces out a particular path and ends up somewhere. Okay, but it's impossible to predict with any certainty where the object will end up based on where it starts, because of the element of randomness there, okay? When I was a kid, I used to play a game called Pick Up Sticks. I don't know how popular this was, but the idea was you would throw a collection of these sticks on the floor, and some of them would land on top of each other, and they'd be intermeshed and so forth, and you have to pick one off at a time without disturbing the pile. Is that popular at all? Has anyone ever heard of that?
Wrong crowd.
Okay. You played it. Okay. So people have played it. But there's randomness in the way those sticks landed. Okay. And you could not predict from the toss how things are going to end up. Okay. All right. So we want to think about randomness and what random processes produce and what they look like. The opposite of a random process is one that has intention or direction. Okay, so it's useful to understand a thing by thinking about its opposite. A directed process is one that involves design or purpose or a particular goal. And so this is something where an outside influence is removing some of the possibilities to make room for a desired outcome or a desired result. And that involves, in every instance that we know of, intelligence being exerted on some system. Okay. Now, there's more to be said about randomness, and we'll think about them more as we go, but there are two options. So if we go back to the first class or the second class, we studied something called the law of excluded middle, and you can use that to formulate a statement that's something like this. Either intelligence, or you could replace intelligence with purpose or design or any of these other synonyms that we've used, either intelligence is responsible for the order and arrangement that we see in the universe, or it's not. That is, either there was intelligence used, intelligence exerted on the universe to make room for desired outcomes, or that was not the case. One of those two options has to be true. It's also true then, from the thinking of the purpose of this class, it's true that evidence along the lines of supporting order and arrangement, of supporting intelligence, of supporting design and purpose, can only be explained by intelligence, and would therefore at least be consistent with the idea of God's existence. Okay? If there is evidence of intelligence in the makeup of the universe, of design in the makeup of the universe, that would be consistent with God's existence and even be an argument in support of God's existence. Okay? So again, we're looking now not at the issue, or not at the fact that the universe exists as opposed to not existing, but we're looking inside of the universe and trying to find any indication that it was designed or ordered or arranged in a complex way. The Bible view of these things is very one-sided. Because the Bible assumes from the very first verse that there is a God and that he is responsible for creation of all that there is. In Psalm 19, verse 1, we read about, and we've looked at this passage before, that the heavens tell of God's glory and they declare his handiwork. They speak about the works of God. In Psalm 139, in verses 13 through 15, let me read those for us, and then we'll see a conclusion in verse 17. But Psalm 139, and verse 13. For you formed my inward parts, you covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Down in verse 17, the psalmist says, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God, how great is the sum of them. So the psalmist looked at himself in that passage to some extent and said, concluded, that I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And so there is a belief there in the design of the universe. Romans chapter 1, verses 20 and 21. Give us an indication, again, we've looked at this passage already, give us an indication that the appropriate response to the creation is faith. We should be able to tell something even about God just on the basis of creation itself. In a different context, Paul talks in Romans chapter 11, verse 33, about the depth of the riches of God's wisdom and knowledge. And he's talking in a different context, relationship between Jew and Gentile and so forth. But the depth of God's wisdom and knowledge is true across domains. God's wisdom and knowledge are unsearchable and unfathomable, according to Paul there in Romans chapter 13. And so, according to the writers of the Bible, of course, design is evident and should point us to God as a designer. But moving on there, let's think about a somewhat formal argument for design. I've underlined the word to there because really we're concerned about an argument that indicates or tells us that there is design in the universe. We don't want to say an argument from design because an argument from design would be presupposing that design exists. So if we've already know that design exists, we could immediately know that there must be a designer. So we want to make an argument that tells us or that concludes that there is design present in the universe. Okay. So an argument goes something like this. If the universe exhibits order and arrangement of sufficient complexity, then there is design in the universe. Okay, now we could talk about what we mean by sufficient complexity there, okay? but we'll let that speak for itself for the time being. In the second place, the universe exhibits order and arrangement, and then the conclusion is, from the first implication, that there must be design in the universe. And if there is design, it's an unstated consequence then, if there is design, that design had to come from somewhere, and that had to come from outside of the universe, which would clearly point to God. So if the universe exhibits order and arrangement, then there is design. The universe does exhibit order and arrangement, therefore there is design in the universe. Okay, so that's the basic argument that we'll look at. It can be formulated in different ways. But we want to start out with looking at three arenas of design. So what are the realms in which we can go out, make observations, make study of the universe, and conclude that there must be design present? The three arenas that I want to look at with you are fine-tuning of the fundamental laws of physics, and then the non-living realm, and then the living realm. Fine-tuning of the fundamental laws of physics, we'll start there today, and then these other two as well, the non-living and living realms. As an overview here of these three arenas of design, we can think about things in this way, I think. So we've already said, based on the cosmological argument, why there is something rather than nothing. And the fact that there must have been a cause to explain the existence of whatever stuff there may be as opposed to its non-existence. But if we take that one step further, once we have stuff present in the universe, how does that stuff behave? And that's the issue of number one here. How does the stuff that we see in the universe relate to itself? How does it interact? What about its fundamental properties make it possible that life can exist, which is what we're most interested in? What about its fundamental properties make it so that it doesn't annihilate itself right away? What about its fundamental properties keep it from just spreading out so quickly that no two particles ever interact with each other in the first place? What about the fundamental properties of physics, fundamental laws, lead to the possibility that complex life can exist, the possibility that we can even be here to talk about the universe in the first place? Okay, so that's where we'll start out, and we'll begin there today. The non-living realm, I have in mind here the order of the, say, the solar system, the order of the Earth, the order of physical properties of matter, but in the non-living realm, that is, things that don't involve life. Okay, we're talking here about rocks and hydrogen and water, things that come to us that we can study in the non-living realm of the universe. And then finally, we'll study life itself, the living realm, where everything you might say that's interesting about the universe, deeply interesting, occurs. So we'll look at these three arenas of design. A sort of comment that you might be tempted to make as you study these things is that if you look at history from, say, the time of maybe the Middle Ages until the present, okay, during that time, secularism, naturalism, a rejection of the supernatural has steadily been increasing. So naturalism has been on the rise, particularly in the 20th century, but even before then. And a rejection, consequently, of God has followed that dominance and dominion of naturalism. But at the same time, as rejection of God has increased, there has been, I believe, and I think we'll see this as we go through these three arenas, there's been an increase in scientific discovery and scientific knowledge that points to his existence. In my mind, the import of this is that for the average, everyday individual living in, say, the past couple of hundred years, subject to the pressures of society, society is becoming more and more secular. I see that all around me. We all see that all around us. But at the same time, it's tempting to think that God has enabled these scientific discoveries to counteract the pressures of this naturalism and secularism and so forth. And so when we look around us, the world is becoming more secular, but at the same time, God has enabled science, if we're looking for it, he's enabled science to show us more of his handiwork. And that's an interesting possibility, at least, that God has superintended that even in the last couple of hundred years. But there are three arenas of design, and so let's jump into the first one. We're talking about the fine-tuning of the physical universe, the fundamental laws that make it up, that make it work. We're not looking at the Earth or the solar system. We're talking about something more fundamental than that, something that involves the laws of physics themselves. Why is it that when an object is in the neighborhood of another object, that there's a force of gravitational attraction between them? How does that work exactly? Well, it depends on the size of this object and the size of this object and some constant between them that causes them to be attracted to each other along a line radial to their centers. But why is it that it works in the way that it does? Or if we think about protons and neutrons, fundamental particles of the physical universe, why is it that they attract one another electromagnetically in the way that they do? Okay, so this is the sort of consideration we're thinking about. I want to look at three examples of fine-tuning. There are many others that you can study, and we'll give sort of an idea for maybe further reading as we go. But we'll go through these quickly, and notice how finely tuned these things must be for life itself to even be a possibility. Not guaranteed by any means, but to be a possibility. The first fine-tuning we want to look at is the relationship between the strength of the electromagnetic force and the strength of the gravitational force. So I've got two circles up on the screen there, and I've got one labeled with a positive charge and one labeled with a negative charge. The one on the left could be a proton, and the one on the right could be an electron. And don't think because I'm using those words that I know what those things mean, okay? You know more about those things than I do, but there's an attraction between them, and that's the electromagnetic force or electrostatic force. So it's understood that a plus one charge and a minus one charge attract with a certain amount of strength, okay? There's a certain amount of strength of attraction between those two. But because those particles also have mass, it's a very small amount, okay? But because a proton has mass and an electron has mass, there's also a gravitational force of attraction between them, okay? So they're attracted to each other electrostatically. So you can think about what happens if you take a balloon and rub it on your head and then stick the balloon on the wall. It will sort of stay put for a while. That's the electromagnetic, electrostatic force that's holding things in place, okay? That's the electric, the force of opposite attraction of electric forces, okay? Gravitational force, though, has to do with the property of mass itself. Gravity is attractive based on the universal law of gravitation, okay? But what's interesting, and what we want to think about, is the relationship between these two forces. The electromagnetic force is vastly stronger than the gravitational force, okay? It's vastly stronger. But if you look at how many times stronger it is, that gives you a ratio. So if I take the strength of the electromagnetic force and divide it by the strength of the gravitational force, I get some ratio. Okay, so the electric force is so many times stronger than the gravitational force, okay? What exactly that ratio is doesn't matter. What matters is how finely tuned it is and how it could not be different by even the smallest imaginable amount. The ratio of the strength of these two forces, if it were different by one part in 10 to the 40th power, would make life impossible. Now, this is not my opinion. This is something I'm taking other scientists' word for. But if there were a difference in this ratio of strengths by the smallest imaginable amount, life itself would not be possible. So if the electromagnetic force were a little stronger relative to gravity, or vice versa, life would be impossible. To try to get an idea of how finely balanced this is, a difference of one part in 10 to the 40th power, we need to think about some very small numbers, okay? Some very small numbers, or the reciprocals of which would be very large numbers, okay? So a way to think about this, first of all, is 10 to the 40th does not mean something like on the order of 40 itself, okay? 10 to the 40th power means 10, the number 10, multiplied by itself 40 times. So you could take 10 times 10 and get 100. That's 10 squared. 10 times 10 times 10 is 1,000. That would be 10 cubed. 10 to the 40th is that same thing done 40 times over again. That number is so unimaginably vast that we can't really wrap our minds around it. There's nothing in our experience that compares to a number of that scale. The fraction 1 divided by 10 to the 40th, so if you take one pizza, say, and divide it into 10 to the 40th pieces, you would have that number there at the bottom. There's a decimal point over here. There should be 39 zeros there, and then a 1 at the very end. Okay, so that's the size of something that is 10 to the 40th in the denominator. So before we look at this next slide, I want to go further into thinking about the small and largeness of the number here, of the numbers. So to give sort of a sense of the scale, the observable universe, that is as far as we can see with the Hubble telescope in one, from one direction to the opposite direction, is approximately 10 to the 26th power feet in diameter. So from one end to the other would be 10 to the 26th feet. So if you're looking at a number like 10 to the 40th, or here I have 10 to the 37th because we're going to look at that number in a minute, 10 to the 37th divided by 10 to the 26th is 10 to the 11th power. It's still 10 billion times greater than the number of feet from one end of the universe, the observable universe, to the other. 10 billion times more than the number of feet across the universe. Okay, so to get 10 to the 37th pieces, we would have to take each foot from one end of the universe to another and divide it into 10 billion pieces, each one of them. 10 billion pieces, 10 billion pieces, 10 billion pieces, and so on across the observable universe. That's how many pieces we would have if we were studying, in this case, 10 to the 37th. 10 to the 40th would just add on 3 more zeros. You would have 10 trillion pieces needed, 10 trillion sub-pieces for each foot in the diameter of the observable universe. The size of these numbers is immense. Okay, it's immense, and I think it's worth spending some time dwelling on and trying to fathom. The idea that if the ratio of the electromagnetic force to the gravitational force were different by one part in 10 to the 40th, life itself would not be possible. It would not be possible. But let's move on. We can go through these fairly quickly. The ratio, here's another one of these issues of fundamental physics that's necessary to make life possible, and if it were different by even a small amount, life would not be possible. The number of electrons to the number of protons, that ratio, how many electrons are there versus how many protons are there in the universe, could not be different by more than one part in 10 to the 37th power. It's smaller than 10 to the 40th power, okay, but still enormously, enormously vast. If it were different by one part in 10 to the 37th, life could not exist. Life could not exist in the way that we know it. So we've talked about large and small numbers. One final example here of fine-tuning in the universe has to do with the mass density of the universe itself. The mass density is computed by taking the size of the universe and dividing it by the... I'm sorry, mass density would be the total mass of the universe, so how much stuff is in the universe, taking our sun and all other stars and planets, all of the mass in the universe, and dividing it by the size or the volume of the universe. When that's done, we come up to a number which is this, 10 to the negative 29th grams of matter. A gram, by the way, is about the weight of a paperclip, okay? 10 to the 29th, negative 29th grams per cubic inch. So on average, across the universe, most of the universe is open space, in each cubic inch, you have 10 to the negative 29th grams of matter, which is an unimaginably small amount. So here is the number, a decimal point on the left, followed by 28 zeros and a one. So many grams, that fraction of a gram per cubic inch. That's the mass density of the universe. Now that number is what it is. What we're interested in is how important it is that the number be where it is and not slightly different. Gravity depends on how much mass you have. If you had a lot more mass in the same size universe, the density would be much higher, and that gravity would cause the universe, according to scientists, to not be able to expand. As a matter of fact, it would tend to collapse down on itself. If you had too much mass, that would be a problem. If you had not enough mass, the opposite would occur. That is, the universe would expand too quickly so that particles would not interact with one another at a sufficient rate. Scientists have calculated, and again, I'm taking their word for this, but they've calculated that if this number, which is approximately, you know, this 0.0001 grams per cubic inch, if it were different by one part in 10 to the 59th power, one part in 10 to the 59th power, life would be impossible because of the relationship between gravity and mass. It would be impossible. So these are three examples that point to fine-tuning of the universe. Again, these are the sorts of things that you've got to spend time thinking about to appreciate how finely balanced these parameters are. But to summarize, there are dozens of examples that are laid out by scientists. This issue was first sort of brought to light in the 80s in a book called The Anthropic Cosmological Principle by two authors named Barrow and Tipler. We'll say more about them in a minute. But there are dozens of such examples where parameters have to be balanced in the finest way imaginable, even beyond our comprehension, for life to even be possible, to even get going in the first place. The anthropic principle itself says that parameters of the universe are critically balanced to be able to permit complex life to ever be a possibility. Now, each one of these parameters by itself is incredibly fine-tuned, but if you take the parameters together, even the three that we've looked at, not to mention dozens of others that have been discovered, by the way, fairly recently, the support for design and intention and purpose in the universe becomes overwhelming. It's staggering how unlikely it would be for these parameters to be selected in the way that they are. You can imagine that for each of these parameters, there's a reasonable spectrum of possible values. And so there's a spectrum for this parameter, spectrum. To get all of these parameters set to where they are is an incredible indication of design. Now, I could say any of this, and it could pass without justification. So I want to take a look at a couple of statements that have been made by famous, well-known astrophysicists and cosmologists. Now, we have to be careful here, I think, because it doesn't do me any good to just take somebody's word for any of the things that we've been looking at. It doesn't do you any good to take my word for it. It doesn't do me any good to take another person's word for it. But what this at the very least does is establishes that the scientific community's understanding of the fine-tuning is very deep and is very much appreciated. Fred Hoyle, who is a 20th century astrophysicist, died early in this century, said a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. He was a famous astrophysicist in England, and he made this statement sometime in the 80s or 90s. Okay? And so Fred Hoyle examined the universe, and he had an idea of this fine-tuning that we're talking about now. I have several of these. I'll try not to bore you with them, but let's go through them quickly. George Ellis, another astrophysicist, English, he said, amazing fine-tuning occurs in the laws of nature that make the complexity that we see in the universe possible. Realization of the complexity of what is accomplished makes it very difficult not to use the word miraculous without taking a stand as to the ontological status of the word. So he basically says, when I look at the fine-tuning of the universe and the complexity that's enabled because of that fine-tuning, the fine-tuning without which none of the complexity would be possible, I cannot say anything but miraculous. At least it's tempting to conclude such a thing. Paul Davies is another astrophysicist. He said, there is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe possible. The impression of design, he says, is overwhelming. And so this is a quotation from another astrophysicist. A Nobel Prize winner in physics said, astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing. That's the Big Bang hypothesis. One with the very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying plan. One might say supernatural. And so he was, again, most of these are atheist individuals, they're committed to atheistic positions, not all of them. But their conclusion is basically, wow. Look at the fine-tuning that we see in these parameters. Okay, a couple of additional ones. Tony Rothman, a physicist, when confronted with the order and beauty of the universe and the strange coincidences of nature, it's very tempting to take the leap of faith from science into religion. I'm sure many physicists want to. I only wish that they would admit it. He is still alive and still working. You can go to his website and see some of the projects he works on. Frank Tipler. So we mentioned a minute ago Barrow and Tipler, who are the authors of The Anthropic Cosmological Principle. Back in 1986, that book came out. Frank Tipler is a mathematical physicist. I don't know if he's still alive or not. He said, when I began my career as a cosmologist 20 years ago, I was a convinced atheist. I never in my wildest dreams imagined that one day I would be writing a book purporting to show that the central claims of Judeo-Christian theology are in fact true, that these claims are straightforward deductions of the laws of physics as we now understand them. I've been forced into these conclusions by the inexorable logic of my own special branch of physics. And so he says, on the basis of this fine-tuning, I cannot but conclude, from an atheistic position, I could not resist the transition to supporting Judeo-Christian theology, he says. Now, I believe when he wrote this line, that he was not in any sense a believer in the Judeo-Christian, what he calls the Judeo-Christian system of theology or belief system. But later, in The Physics of Christianity, which he wrote in 2007, he did convert to some sort of a belief in Christianity. And he said, from the perspective of the latest physical theories, Christianity is not a mere religion, but an experimentally testable science. Now, we have to take what he says with a grain of salt, but the point that we need to see is that physicists, scientists have observed the parameters necessary, the fine-tuning thereof, necessary for the existence of life, and they cannot but conclude, at least be tempted, to consider the possibility of design, of intention in the way those things are set up. Werner von Braun, who was a rocket engineer, you can see a lot of his proto-rockets in Smithsonian Space Museum, said, I find it is difficult to understand a scientist who does not acknowledge the presence of a superior rationality behind the existence of the universe. That was a mouthful. As it is to comprehend a theologian who would deny the advances of science. He says it's as difficult to understand an unbelieving scientist as it is to believe or to acknowledge a theologian who rejects science out of hand. That's an interesting quotation. I think there's a lot of wisdom therein. Briefly, the response by the naturalist. Now, there are still atheists in view of all of this fine-tuning. They persist. Many individuals persist in atheism. And so they give a response. They recognize the fine-tuning. That's not in question. That's been established. And so we're all dealing with the same facts. But they give a response, an explanation of this fine-tuning, which is a multiverse theory. Basically, the idea there is, yes, these parameters must be finely tuned. But here's my explanation. There must be, to explain this enormous coincidence, there must be somewhere a universe machine that's cranking out universes with all possible values of these parameters, some of which we've looked at today. All possible values exist somewhere in some universe. We can't see that universe or ever find it or ever come close to it, but there are universes out there, a multitude of them, an unimaginably large number of them, and we just happen to be in the universe that's finely tuned. And that's the response of those who would persist in naturalism, that there was no intelligence, we just happened to have gotten lucky. And you can decide for yourself what you think about a theory that postulates universes that cannot be observed, can never be detected, not to mention a universe-making machine or mechanism that produces these universes in the first place. With a little bit of time left, I want to show you a quick poll, which actually suggests, I think, that we may have been a little bit duped. If you listen to the news, if you watch popular programming, if you watch Hollywood, which I recommend strongly that you don't ever pay much attention to Hollywood or things that come out of it, even at the level of, I won't go there, but you need to be careful. We need to be careful what we spend time filling our heads with, paying attention to. It may be the case that atheism is not nearly so popular as many people want us to believe that it is. A poll in 2006 came out, said 95%, now that was 12 years ago, okay, so things have changed in the last 12 years. 95% of Americans believe in either God or a higher power, and 4% hold an atheistic position. Among scientists, there is a greater element of disbelief, of atheism, of rejection of God. In May and June of 2009, Pew Research put out a poll that said 51% of scientists, members of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, believe in either God or a higher power. 33% believe in God. 41% of scientists who are in that membership hold an atheistic position. Okay, so there is more disbelief in God among atheists. You might wonder why that is. You might consider the possibility of knowledge puffing up and so forth and making arrogant, as we talked about last week, but those are the numbers. But that's fairly stable across time. In 1914, a survey of 1,000 American scientists found that 42% believe in a personal God, and 42%, the same number, do not believe in a personal God. To conclude with this morning, we have just a couple of minutes left, and I want to make some reference to Scripture to sort of put these things in perspective and to see what Scripture says about the sorts of fine-tuning ideas that we've talked about. Scripture is known for and very good at understatement. What do I mean by that? The most obvious example that comes to mind is the crucifixion of Christ. The crucifixion in the gospel accounts is understated in an incredible way. If you look, for example, in John's account, it says, "And they crucified him." And that's the crucifixion. There are some details discussed, but how could you further understate the greatest event in the history of the world than to say, "And they crucified him"? the scripture understates many things that it teaches us. In Psalm 102 and verse 25, "Of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands." Indeed, he did. Indeed, God did lay the foundation of the world. But how much more could have been said about that? In view of the fine-tuning of the universe, the way these parameters are so well balanced for life to exist, "You laid the foundation of the earth." Surely more could be said about that, but that's where Scripture leaves it, at least in that passage. In Genesis 1:1, God created the heavens and the earth, and there it is. That's all it says. Now, there's some details that are provided later on, but what understatement is present? Genesis 2 and verse 1. "Thus the heavens and the earth and all the hosts in them were finished." We can go forward from there. We can come over to Jeremiah chapter 32 and verse 7. "Ah, Lord God, behold, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. There is nothing too hard for you." And so we'll leave things there and pick up next week, going further down the design line of arguments. Thank you.